Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today our topic will be the Civil War, but first let's make our topic our imaginations. Let's pretend it's late on a summer night and we're driving along a highway at 70 miles an hour and we're part of a line of cars and trucks and buses. Before we know it, our vehicle and the rest of the traffic begins to cross a bridge and the bridge gives way. Brakes screeching, metal screaming, down we all go, cars and trucks and buses into a little river. 20 drivers and passengers wind up dead, 12 injured. Investigation reveals that some group of malefactors sabotaged that bridge just before we came to it. In this imaginary drama, if you were one of the survivors, you'd be outraged. If you were a member of the public, you'd be horrified. These days, we'd suspect terrorism. Now, without having to use our imaginations, let's move that same horror and outrage back a century and a half to 1861, and you'd know how Missourians felt when that very same number of people, 20, were killed and injured, 12, when a Hannibal and Pacific Railroad train crashed off a bridge into the Platte River north of Kansas City, not far from St. Joseph. Saboteurs, it turned out, had set fire to the bridge supports, and at 11 p.m. on the night of September 3rd, 1861, that train rolled onto that weakened and collapsing bridge. Well, Missouri had to do something, and so the guerrilla hunters were born. Our guest today has written a book about how Missouri fought back against guerrilla violence, how thousands of Missourians were mustered into militia service to fight the bands of men and even boys who menaced Missouri in the perilous years of the Civil War. Our guest is James W. Irwin, author of Guerrilla Hunters in Civil War, Missouri. He joins us from Clayton Studios in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Jim, and welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, Jim, in our part of the world, here in Missouri, the Civil War brought far more acts of terror than it did engagements between big organized forces of troops. Tell us, please, about the kind of people who were these guerrillas, the terrorists of that era.
Well, the guerrillas, you would think, were perhaps criminals before the war, but actually they weren't. They were just ordinary citizens who went into guerrilla warfare primarily because the conventional Confederate armies had been driven out of the state of Missouri by late 1861 and early 1862. Cole Younger, for example, was a citizen in Harrisonville. His father was mayor of the town. They were respected folks. William Quantrill was a teacher before the war. There were others. They were just ordinary folks, and this was the way in which they decided they were going to fight their war.
Now, we know that some of them did become criminals after the war, and a good example is the James brothers.
Right, but their family owned a hemp farm north of Kansas City, had several slaves. They were fairly successful, and they were just ordinary folks before the war. They weren't involved in any kind of criminal activity at all. And yet, during the war, they joined one of the most violent bands led by Bloody Bill Anderson. And after the war, of course, they became bank and train robbers.
Now, something got them, transformed them from ordinary peace-loving citizens into these rather violent raiders. What was that?
Well, there were a number of things. Many of them did it for revenge. I mentioned Cole Younger. His father was murdered by federal soldiers in 1862. Frank James actually joined the Confederate forces. The Missouri State Guard fought at the Battle of Wilson's Creek, became sick, left the army, and then joined a guerrilla band. Jesse James wanted to join when he was only 15 years old, but he wasn't allowed to join for another year. But while he was at home, his farm was invaded by federal soldiers who took his stepfather, hung him, swung him by his neck to try to get him to disclose where Frank was hiding. He finally did, and they went after Frank James. Of course, that's the sort of thing that would turn you against anyone.
Indeed, it would. And they were dangerous to everybody else because they came out of nowhere, didn't wear uniforms some of the time, and then could just melt back into the countryside, into the population.
That's true. And sometimes the uniforms they did wear were those of federal soldiers. So when you saw them coming, you weren't sure if they were guerrillas or federal soldiers. Sometimes it didn't make any difference.
In fact, in our part of the world, the Civil War may have been as scary as anywhere because you just never knew whom you were talking to.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And I've read that sometimes, if to take another current day example, if we were sitting in our house out in the countryside, if we owned a farm, and a group of guys drove up in cars and got out of their cars and pickups with guns and approached the door, that'd be a frightening prospect. But this happened to farms all across western Missouri in those days.
All across the state, western Missouri, southwestern Missouri, southeastern Missouri, from the Iowa border down to Arkansas, the guerrilla warfare was all throughout Missouri. And yes, that's the way it was. And sometimes people would have to lie. They would try to judge whether these folks were guerrillas or federal soldiers posing as guerrillas, and tell them what they wanted to hear, what they hoped they wanted to hear.
What a nasty time. And so, as a result of that, probably from some citizen pressure, the governor of Missouri decided it was time to start some kind of counteractivity to this guerrillas. What were some of the efforts they tried?
Well, initially they had a militia that had been raised by the state of Missouri. The militia was very poorly armed, poorly led, poorly equipped, not very effective. Many volunteer units from other states and also from Missouri were diverted from the conventional armies, Grant and Sherman, to provide security for Missouri. The governor of Missouri, Hamilton Gamble, wanted to have a force that would be more or less under the control of Missourians, or at least dedicated to fighting the guerrillas in Missouri. His problem was that Missouri had no money. They had $21,000 in the bank in October of 1861. So he reached an agreement with President Lincoln for the federal government to pay for and to equip a force called the Missouri State Militia, which was about initially 14,000, later 10,000 men who were dedicated to fighting the guerrillas. They were unusual in that they were a federal force, but they were only to be used in the state of Missouri and only go outside the state in emergency circumstances. They did go out a few times, but rarely. And they were enlisted for the duration of the war in Missouri, and their mission was to hunt down the guerrillas and kill them.
Governor Gamble succeeded in persuading Abraham Lincoln to do this in Missouri. There were other border states. Did they face the same problem, and did they respond the same way, Kentucky, for instance?
They faced a similar problem, but they didn't respond in the same way. The Missouri State Militia was unique in its organization. In Kentucky, they had that familiar with Kentucky, but in Kentucky they had other federal troops similar to what had been there before the militia in Missouri that were used to attack the guerrillas. And in Tennessee also suffered a lot of guerrilla warfare, but Tennessee was a battleground, so there were already regular federal troops in Tennessee, Memphis, Chattanooga, Nashville, and elsewhere. In fact, they were in Tennessee almost throughout the entire war, so they had regular troops fighting the guerrillas in those areas.
Now, there's a popular conception over here on the west side of the state, and true, that there were two sorts of guerrilla bands. There were the bushwhackers, people who may or may not have been Southern sympathizers, but they seemed to come out, align themselves that way. And then there were the Jayhawkers and the Redlegs and people who crossed the border from Kansas. This Missouri State Militia, was it organized to combat both?
No, not really. The Jayhawkers, of course, were Union, or at least nominally Union. They were certainly very anti-Missouri. The problem they had, the Jayhawkers were so violent towards Missourians that they ended up sending the worst of them to other theaters, to Arkansas, to Tennessee, and elsewhere, rather than have them operate in Kansas and in Missouri. But when they got there, they pretty much operated in the same fashion towards the citizens of those states as well. The Missouri State Militia was organized to fight the guerrillas. The Jayhawkers, the Kansas troops were Union troops. They also were supposed to be fighting guerrillas. Sometimes they didn't distinguish between guerrillas and Unionists. If you lived in Missouri, you were pretty much fair game in their view.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and today we're hearing about Missourians who signed up a century and a half ago to fight against the likes of Quantrill and Bloody Bill and their guerrillas. Our guest is James W. Irwin, author of Guerrilla Hunters in Civil War, Missouri. Jim, how did you get interested in this whole topic of the guerrilla warfare?
Well, I guess I have to go back to how I got interested in the Civil War to begin with. It goes back quite a ways. When I was about 8 years old, my grandparents had this house with a large number of built-in bookshelves, and they needed something to fill them in to make it look nice. One of the books they bought at some sort of a sale was a book written about the Battle of Shiloh. It was published by the government publishing office. And it's published in 1913. It had these very large fold-out maps, and it went through what each unit did during the Battle of Shiloh. I got a hold of that book when I was 8 years old, got interested in the Civil War. Later, I got my father to take me out to the various battlefields in southwest Missouri where I lived at the time. And from there, it kind of was a lifelong interest in the Civil War, specifically on the guerrilla war. My wife is from Mexico, Missouri, and mm-hmm. one of the incidents I write about, one of the famous incidents of the Civil War in Missouri is the Centralia Massacre. Centralia is only a few miles from Mexico, so anyone from that area is familiar with it. And that was really what got me started, was looking into that particular incident and what happened there, and then looking in general at the guerrilla warfare in Missouri.
Well, the Centralia Massacre was an outrageous incident. Can you describe it for us, and then what the response of the Missouri State Militia and the Union troops was to it?
Sure. Well, it was in September 1864. A number of guerrillas, probably 400 or 500, had gathered near the town of Centralia. Bill Anderson took about 80 men into the town of Centralia, probably included Frank and Jesse James. They ransacked the town. There was a stage that drove up. On the stagecoach was James S. Rollins, and if any of your listeners have ever attended the University of Missouri, they probably recognize that name because he's recognized as one of the fathers of the University of Missouri. Mm-hmm. He was not recognized, however, by the guerrillas, but he was robbed. While they were doing that, a train pulled in from the east. They stopped the train. On the train were 125 civilians and 24 unarmed Union soldiers who were on leave from Sherman's army. This was shortly after the capture of Atlanta. They robbed the civilians. The Union soldiers were stripped down to their underwear, and then they took one as a prisoner, and they gunned down the rest in cold blood. They left those men there, went back to their camp outside of town. A couple of hours later, a battalion of Union troops had been trailing the guerrillas, came into town, saw what had happened. The commander was outraged. He left a few men in town, took the rest out to attack the guerrillas, apparently not knowing or not believing the townsfolk, who said there were far more in the camp than had actually come into the town. They were ambushed. About 115 men, all but two or three, were killed in a space of 5 minutes or maybe less. There was the Centralia Massacre, which was the killing of the unarmed soldiers at the train station, and the Battle of Centralia. It almost doesn't deserve to be called a battle, but so many men died in such a short time, you have to call it a battle. And that occurred a few hours later. That day, over almost 150 men were killed, including soldiers and civilians. Some of those were also killed.
So there's every reason in the world to respond by creating some kind of force to try to seek out these guerrillas. On the cover of your book, there's a very handsome, well-uniformed guy standing at attention, looking off as if he's looking for guerrillas in the Union uniform. The Missouri State Militia wasn't necessarily quite as spiffy as all that.
Yeah, actually, the guy on the front of the book is from the 2nd Missouri Cavalry, also known as Merrill's Horse. Uh-huh. They were one of the units, though, that fought the guerrillas, particularly in the summer of 1862. And I have practically a whole chapter about them, but... It was a regular volunteer unit. There's only one image or photograph I've ever seen of the Missouri State Militia where there was more than, you know, just an individual photograph of a person who went to a studio. That's actually in the book, and it shows a formation of them, about a company of them in St. Joseph in 1864. Mm-hmm. And they are much more, shall we say, their uniforms much more diverse. slouch hats, forage hats, checked shirts. They do have blue coats, but that's probably about the only thing you can call a uniform.
In fact, weren't they supposed to wear a bit of white cloth on their headgear?
It got to the point where so many guerrillas were wearing federal uniforms that they started wearing, actually they alternated. They were supposed to alternate days. On one day they would wear white and one day they would wear red. They also had an elaborate system of hand signals and passwords and what have you, so that they could try to distinguish between guerrillas and federal troops when they saw them at a distance. Because, you know, obviously, with no radios or any other kind of communication, you saw somebody riding up 300 or 400 yards in the distance in blue coats. You know, if was it our guys or was it the guerrillas?
In fact, you write about a group, a little party of 14 or so Union troopers who are riding out, mm-hmm. and they come upon a band of, what, 40, 60 people dressed in blue Union coats and don't know what to make of them.
Right, and it turns out they were guerrillas, and all but one or two were killed, and that was a frequent occurrence, particularly later in the war.
We began the show talking about the Platte River bridge collapse that was sabotaged mm-hmm. by guerrillas, and you've mentioned the Centralia massacre too. Railroads were everything in those days.
Yes, actually, that's where the guerrilla warfare started. Was in particularly in North Missouri, because of the attacks on railroads between Hannibal and St. Joseph and between St. Louis and Macon. And that was the initial impetus to try to organize troops to go after guerrillas.
Right. And what a time, whether you're a civilian or a soldier, nobody seems to want to wear, well, it seems like too often people just don't mind the rules and aren't wearing the correct uniform.
Well, that's true.
And so that makes the Civil War even more of a terrorist time than we might imagine. The Missouri State Militia had to do a lot in the way of cavalry. They had to have horses and they had to have armaments to ride. Why was cavalry so important?
Well, the guerrillas were essentially cavalry. That was the way in which they got around. They were reputed to be very, very good horsemen. It gave them a good deal of mobility. They could strike, ambush a column of troops or ambush a train, get on their horses and be gone and spread out, hide away in the bush. In order to track them down, you needed to have cavalry to catch up with them. The infantry really was only good for guarding bridges or towns or something like that. It was the cavalry that had to be out there trying to find the guerrillas, tracking them down and trying to find their camps in the woods or wherever they might be.
Both the militia and the guerrillas were as variously weaponed as they were uniformed. What kind of different weapons did they use? What were their arsenals?
Well, the militia was actually armed with infantry weapons, muskets, primarily Austrian muskets, had been imported from Austria. They were sort of obsolete or obsolescent things. It wasn't that bad a deal for the Missouri State Militia because almost always they fought dismounted. Their horses were used to catch up with the guerrillas, but when they caught them, they would dismount and then they would fight as if they were infantry. They also had an unusual revolver called a Savage revolver with two triggers, an upper trigger and a lower trigger. The lower trigger was used to cock the revolver and the upper trigger was used to fire it. And you hope that somebody could remember the difference between the two in the heat of battle. The guerrillas and actually the Union troops, too, had multiple revolvers. Revolvers were really the guerrillas' weapon of choice because they typically fought in ambushes at close quarters. The revolver, of course, had six rounds in it. You could get a lot of volume of fire, particularly if you carried three or four or sometimes even six of them, the guerrillas would carry. They also had shotguns and rifles as well. The Union soldiers began to try to equip themselves in very much the same way. They might be issued one of these Savage revolvers by the government, but the savvy guy, if he had the money, would buy his own revolver or maybe a couple of them and carry those as well. So they would have two or three of their own, plus their rifle or perhaps their carbine, similar to the one that's on the cover of the book. The weapons were sort of miscellaneous, shall we say. They were not the same thing that the regular cavalry had, in the East or even in the Western Theater in Tennessee and Georgia.
And those woodcut illustrations you see in Harper's Illustrated and other things showing guerrillas usually showed mean-looking guys with a bunch of pistols stuck in their belt because some of them were still using single-shot pistols. Is that correct?
Yes, they also had the revolvers, which were, these were cap-and-ball revolvers that were loaded the same way as a musket, except, of course, you had six rounds. It was sort of a difficult, time-consuming way to load them. But nonetheless, if you carried three or four of those, that would be 12, 18 rounds you could get off before you had to either go back and reload or get away. Some of the Missouri State Militia still had what they called horse pistols, which were single-shot pistols from the Mexican War, incredibly obsolete, probably pretty much useless. I doubt if they could really hit anything with them anyway.
Now, you write that, as in so many wars, health problems usually were a greater danger to the members of the Missouri State Militia than were guerrillas.
That's right. Really, the first battles they fought were with disease. One of the units I write about had 20 men die of measles within the first couple of months of their service. So childhood diseases were a big problem, at least initially in the war. And then as the war dragged on, because of where they were stationed and where they fought and rivers and so forth and in poor sanitary conditions in camps, there were difficulties with chronic diarrhea, typhoid, and other similar types of diseases. They had a very bad diet. The standard government food was a hardtack, which is a hard cracker. That's when it was in good condition. When it was in bad condition, you had to pick the worms out. Salt pork. They were deficient in vitamin C. Scurvy was a problem in the Army during the war. Now, in Missouri, in fact, one of the guys I write about, George Woltz, frequently, or at least a couple of times, writes his folks at home and says, well, we're near an apple orchard, or we're near a peach orchard, or we're eating cherries. So they would go out and get fruit, not necessarily because they knew they needed it for vitamin C, but because it was a variation on their ordinary diet.
Is the history of guerrilla fighters still visible or talked about in your community, Missourians, or do you have a question about the guerrilla fighters? You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us. Our handle is KCURCST. And our guest this morning is Jim Irwin, author of Guerrilla Hunters in Civil War Missouri. Jim, the problem with the guerrillas finding them was that they could melt into the countryside because so many of them had families nearby. Is that right?
That's right. And actually, something that's been often overlooked but has become more to the fore in recent years is the role of women in the guerrilla war. You know, their men, their husbands, their fathers, their sons, whatever, went off to join the guerrillas or join the conventional armies. But the women stayed behind. They were the ones operating the farms. They provided food. They provided shelter. They provided clothing. They provided intelligence, information about where Union troops were. And in areas that were areas of strong Southern sympathy, this was a very valuable resource for the guerrillas. I mean, they didn't have a quartermaster corps. They didn't have depots to provide them with these kinds of things. They had to get it from the countryside. And many of them actually had a whole network of family. And they would go from maybe where their wife lived to where their aunt and uncle lived or their grandparents or something like that and move from place to place in almost a circuit around the area in which they were operating.
And you write in your book that one of the responses of the Union side of things was because they couldn't go directly out and find these folks, they would punish everyone. Early on, they made towns pay for the rebuilding of railroads that were destroyed by guerrillas nearby. And then, of course, in this part of the country, we know about Order Number 11.
Exactly. Order Number 11, the notorious Order Number 11, which was put in force shortly after the destruction of Lawrence, Kansas in August of 1863, in which civilians in four counties, Jackson, Cass, Bates, and Northern Vernon County, were required to leave within 15 days and take whatever they could with them. And unfortunately for those civilians, not only were they required to leave in that short a time, but the Commander General Ewing sent in Kansas troops to enforce the order, which made it even worse because they drove people out even before the 15 days was up and burned their homes, stole their grain, burned it, and that sort of thing. Probably somewhere between 10 and 20,000 folks were affected by that. It was the largest forced evacuation of civilians in the friendly areas of the United States until the internment of the Japanese Americans in World War II.
And so there they were, some innocents and some people who had been harboring guerrillas, with the few being punished for the many being punished for the sins, shall we say, of a few. Well, that's interesting, Jim Irwin. We'll be back after the break to talk more about the Missouri troops who went on the prowl for guerrilla fighters in the Civil War. And we'll talk a little bit about some answers to the street name questions that you came up with a month ago. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today we're discussing the hunt for guerrillas in the Civil War by Missourians who signed up for the state militia. With us is James W. Irwin of Kirkwood, Missouri, who has written Guerrilla Hunters in Civil War Missouri, just published by the History Press. Jim, if you can hold on just a second, we have a little bit of business to take care of from our last show a month ago. In that local history segment, we talked about street names across the Kansas City metropolitan area, specifically how they got named that way, these streets. There are a lot of streets, and not every reason for naming every street is known or clear today. Our three local historians on that show in early May knew a lot of answers, but a few eluded them, and me too. I promised to try to find those answers, and here are the results so far. Kathleen in Brookside wondered how Winthrop Road got its name, and Mary in Kansas City asked about Concord Road. Well, these streets are both in J.C. Nichols' pioneering subdivisions built in the early 20th century. Winthrop is in Armor Hills. That development runs from Edgevale Road just east of Brookside Boulevard to Oak Street. Winthrop curves along between 68th Terrace and 69th. The whole subdivision dates back to 1922. Now, the Winthrop is spelled with an E, so you'd think, well, it must have been some relative, some famous person, some somebody. But not really. In fact, a lot of things were rather hazy about that era. In fact, the same view that shows Winthrop for the first time, it's a bird's eye done in the early 20s, also shows rows of shops at the intersection of Edgevale, 69th Street, and Brookside. As we all know, no shops ever appeared there. They're single-family homes today. Now, Concord Road runs east from near Warnell, almost to Brookside Boulevard. Concord is in the countryside area, a part of Nichols' original country club district, which was developed around 1910. For insight, I turned to historian William S. Worley, who did exhaustive research for an excellent book about J.C. Nichols and his well-known development. And Worley pointed out that although the exact reasons for naming these streets Concord and Winthrop and others may never be completely known, Nichols did lean toward British-sounding names in many of his subdivisions, sounded Tony, perhaps. For instance, not far from Concord and Winthrop lie Huntington and Westover and Grassmere. Indeed, Kansas City real estate developers had a record of liking English titles, for instance, Hyde Park. One part of Baltimore, Maryland, called Roland Park, like ours but without an E, had a big influence on Nichols. Roland Park in Maryland has streets named Midvale, Beechdale, Elmhurst, Hawthorne, and Inglewood, all evoking British air. In fact, Edgevale in Kansas City probably came directly from the Edgevale in Roland Park, Baltimore, Maryland. If anyone out there knows more about the naming of Concord and Winthrop, we'd love to hear it. We had a little more luck on Sheely Road, which runs in a northeast-southwest direction in Independence. It's between Sterling and Chrysler Avenues and just south of 27th Street. By the way, it's spelled S-H-E-L-E-Y. For the answer to that street name, we turn to the Jackson County Historical Society, Independence, and its resident expert, David Jackson. David noted that a family named Sheely owned a substantial amount of property in that area now occupied by Sheely Road. There was Judge James Sheely, who died in 1893. Horace Sheely was a real estate operator and lawyer who served as mayor of Independence in the late 1870s. Another well-known resident of the area at that time was Horace's brother, Dr. O.C. Sheely. David Jackson also would like to hear from anyone who has more information on the naming of Sheely Road. For Martha in Lawson, Missouri, who wondered where the name Drexel Road came from, Martha, if you're referring to Northeast Drexel Road, which lies west of Shoto Traffic Way in the Northland, well, I still don't know, but I'm not giving up. Finally, a caller asked whether the curve in today's Valentine Road had anything to do with a horse track that once operated in that area. And all the study I could do of maps of the time and in between, indicate that there was another set of streets entirely devised for the area before Valentine ever came along. So there's little indication that Valentine was curved because of a horse track. At any rate, we thank everyone for their calls back last month, and I hope this starts to answer some of those questions. Now let's get back to Jim Irwin and talk about the Missouri State Militias of the Civil War, the people who went out to fight guerrillas. You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can tweet us, and our handle is KCURCST. Jim, you mentioned that the governor of Missouri went to Abraham Lincoln to get money to fund these things, which, of course, inevitably brought up the problem of who's in charge here. Who was in charge of these militias?
Well, part of the deal was that the commander of the militia was going to be whoever was the commander of the troops in Missouri, and Governor Gamble agreed to that. He was allowed to appoint the field grade officers, which were majors, lieutenant colonels, and colonels, the commanders of the regiment. The company grade officers were elected by the men. There came a dispute in about a year or so later between Governor Gamble and the federal government over whether he could remove the officers that he had appointed, in particular a Colonel Jackson, who was operating down in southeast Missouri. He got into it with General Halleck, who at that time was the chief of staff of the Union Army in Washington, D.C. Halleck said he did not have that authority because they were in federal service. Gamble claimed that he did have that authority and that he wanted to get rid of this officer because he was incompetent. Eventually, it went to President Lincoln, just another headache that came to Lincoln from Missouri. There were a number of them, but this was another one. And Lincoln said, nothing exasperates me more than having to deal with these things. Let him say that he can remove the officer, and then the Secretary of War can approve whatever he does, basically rubber stamp it. And the officer was, in fact, removed. And that's the way it was handled.
We think of Abe Lincoln as one of our most beleaguered presidents, perhaps our most beleaguered, and this is just one more case, and it came straight out of this here on the west of the Mississippi River, excuse me.
Yes, he had a – go ahead.
You go ahead, Jim.
Well, there was another case where there was a minister in St. Louis who they wanted – the federal commander wanted to get rid of, and this went back and forth between St. Louis and Washington, D.C. for a number of months, and finally – President Lincoln said, why does the president of the United States have to decide who can preach in a church in St. Louis?
Now, in this part of the world, up in Platte County and Clinton County in the mid-1860s, in the height of the Civil War, there was a group of militia formed a little bit separate from the Missouri State Militia. It came to be called the Paw Paw Militia. Who are these guys and why were they called that?
The Paw Paw Militia were actually former Confederate soldiers. The thought of the federal commander who raised them was that, well, it's better to have them under our control than it is to have them out there not under our control.
Mm-hmm.
And they were primarily raised actually to combat rogue Kansans. There's those Jayhawkers again, who were coming across the river into that area and raiding into Missouri, not actually going after guerrillas, but just simply raiding the place and stealing horses and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
There was a good deal of political controversy over it because particularly radical Republicans in Missouri were saying, why are we arming former Confederates?
Yes.
The Paw Paw Militia got their name supposedly from the plants that were in the Missouri River bottoms called Paw Paws. I don't know. There's various stories, but that's one of them. As it turned out, in 1864, a number of these members of the Paw Paw Militia actually did turn coat again and joined Confederates for a while, at least, until they were dispersed by federal troops. So that was a very controversial collection of a couple of regiments up in that area.
Yeah, one of the stories I've heard about the Pawpaws is that it was thought that they were just fine until it came a time to do any military action, and then they would disappear into the pawpaw trees.
Yeah, right.
Which is apparently, as I understand it, kind of what they did when a Confederate force approached Platte City, which was supposed to be defended by the Paw Paw Militia. Tell us what happened then.
Well, the Confederate force came into Platte City. There were a number of guerrillas, including Jesse James and others from the guerrilla band that he was a member of at the time. And the Pawpaws, instead of defending it, essentially switched sides. And they went over to the Confederates. They all had a kind of a celebration. Jesse James had his photograph taken. It's a very well-known photograph you see of Jesse with his guns and his guerrilla shirt on. And then they went out to have a picnic and celebrate it. But it was broken up by federal troops that rode in through the picnic and ended up killing a bunch of the men and scattering the Confederate troops and the Pawpaws, former Pawpaws.
That's amazing that Jesse James, part of the guerrilla band, could feel so comfortable about this raid. The Pawpaws had disappeared so completely that he could take the time to have his photo taken, which was not a brief event in those days.
No.
Now we have an emailer. Rick from Brookside has a book recommendation called Enemy Woman. He says it's an excellent book about women supporting the Confederate soldiers in the woods. So there you are, Jim, if you mentioned the women on the side of things. In fact, the death of a few women in Kansas City and the collapse of a building helped precipitate the Quantrill's raid on Lawrence.
Yes. As I mentioned, the role of women in the guerrilla warfare, that was actually recognized by the federal commander at the time, General Ewing, in Kansas City. And he ordered the arrest of a number of women, including relatives of guerrillas such as John McCorkle and Bill Anderson's sisters. They were confined in a building, in a home, the home of George Caleb Bingham, the Missouri painter, who was also a politician. He was actually the state treasurer of the state of Missouri during the Civil War. Then the building collapsed, and several of the women were killed, including one of Anderson's sisters. Several were severely injured, including some of Anderson's sisters and others. And it certainly made them more determined to kill as many men as they could when they got to Lawrence, Kansas. Now, this building was located, I believe it was at 1432 Grand, mm-hmm. across the street from the Sprint Center.
Mm-hmm.
At least I've seen the plaque.
Yes. Yeah, and space mostly occupied by Interstate Loop Highway these days.
Well, there you go.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and we're talking with Jim Irwin about his book, Guerrilla Hunters in Civil War, Missouri, recently published by the History Press. Now, speaking of Bill Anderson, who came to be called Bloody Bill Anderson, Jim, he was put to death just over in Ray County. Tell us how he was hunted down.
Well, I mentioned that he ambushed federal troops in Centralia. He mm-hmm. was involved in a similar type ambush, except this time he was a victim of it in Ray County. He was being tracked by a group of soldiers being led by Samuel P. Cox. What Cox did was array his men in the woods and send out a party to go attack the guerrillas and then retreat. Anderson and his men followed these men who were retreating, and they retreated into an ambush. He was shot down. They didn't realize who they had at first until they started rifling through his pockets, and they found an order in there from General Price directed to Bill Anderson to go over and build to burn down a bridge and so forth in St. Charles County. They realized who they had, so they took his body into Richmond, where it was photographed.
Uh-huh.
And if you see the photograph, you could see him in his guerrilla shirt and his multiple revolvers and his plumed hat and so forth. And then he was buried in an unmarked grave. And that was the end of Bill Anderson. And pretty much the end of guerrilla warfare in Missouri. It lingered on for a while into 1865, but nowhere near the kind of intensity that it had reached in 1864.
Let's go to the phones now, and Susan from Parkville. Susan, thank you for waiting, and good morning.
Well, hi. I'm also from Mexico, Missouri, and my mother's family was from Boone County, and I'm calling to see if you had come across in your research the death of William S. Cave, who was a physician in Boone County, and he was taken behind his barn and shot by Union soldiers for being suspected of being a Southern sympathizer.
I haven't come across that specifically, but there were a number of instances of that, particularly from the Union soldiers who were German Americans who were avidly against. Well, they pretty much treated other Missourians the way Jayhawkers treated other Missourians. There was a group led by a battalion led by a Arnold Kreckel from St. Charles, who was notorious for doing just that sort of thing, and they ended up having to disband him.
Well, as you were talking about the guerrillas, they were forcing folks from the area to feed them, and so my great-great-whatever fed them at gunpoint, and then the Unionists thought they were sympathizers. Right. And one of the prized possessions in our family is to get a copy of the Bill of Sale, and his widow refused to live in that part of Missouri anymore, and she sold off everything they owned so she could move away. And when a bride in our family is getting married, we each get a framed copy of her Bill of Sale for her farm.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan. Jim, that just shows that memories are anything but short, especially when it comes to Civil War in Missouri.
Yes, if you got time for another story like that, I can tell you something that happened to me in the last couple of weeks.
Go ahead.
I was speaking about my book, and a person came up to me afterwards and said that their ancestor, great-great-grandfather, whoever, had been killed by a guerrilla named Alvin Cobb. A couple of weeks after that, I was giving another presentation on my book, and a guy came up afterwards and said his ancestor was Alvin Cobb. And so I did not want to invite those two to the same party, but it was the memories are long.
Yes, and sometimes they have a sort of a silly thing when it comes to sports teams and things, but they were very, very, very real a century and a half ago. And families, obviously, from the caller, don't forget that kind of thing. Now, later in the Civil War, Jim, the radical Republicans rose in importance in Missouri, and they began to complain that the Missouri State Militia was supposed to go out and hunt guerrillas, but was a little too easy on the secessionists and a little too protective of slavery. What about the politics toward the end of the war?
Well, the politics of Missouri were very, there's a book about it called Turbulent Partnership, and I think that describes it. They were very turbulent. The provisional government was actually unelected. It had been put in place after the elected government had been driven out of the Missouri, or much of the elected government driven out of Missouri in 1861, and radical Republicans were opting for elections, and the provisional government didn't want to have elections. The Unionists were actually split into three parties over the issue of slavery. Missouri, of course, was a slave state, even though it remained in the Union. And there were those who were called snowflakes who wanted to keep slavery. And the snowflakes' motto was the Constitution as it is, the Union as it was. Then there were the claybanks, which were typified by Governor Gamble, who came to realize by the middle of the war that slavery was not going to survive, but they wanted a gradual compensated emancipation of the slaves. And then there were the radical Republicans, and they were called the charcoals, and they wanted immediate uncompensated emancipation. They won the election in 1864. They came to power, and in fact, Missouri abolished slavery in the state by the adoption of the Missouri Constitution, a new Missouri Constitution, on January 11th, 1865, which incidentally was a couple of weeks before the events portrayed in the movie Lincoln and the adoption of the passage of the 13th Amendment by Congress.
So if Missouri didn't have a complex enough situation, sitting as it did on the border, there's also the consideration that it was a state where slavery was legal through most of the Civil War, and where there had been a state group that wanted to go join the Confederacy, and basically they were sent packing to Southwest Missouri and then on, I guess, to Texas, and the state stayed in the Union. What? Wow.
Yeah. And the Missouri State Militia and other federal troops constantly struggled with what to do with runaway slaves. I mean, mm-hmm. Under Missouri law, they should be returned. In fact, under Missouri law, they could be auctioned off like property, like a piece of ground or something else, because under Missouri law, as weird and as strange and as terrible as it sounds today, they were considered property. And, Union soldiers, particularly those from other states, were very much against returning runaway slaves. Those from Missouri, on the other hand, had more, let's say, a more diverse set of attitudes about it. Some returned them and some didn't.
Wow, it's just not easy. It's not simply blue versus simply gray. Now, the Missouri State Militia wasn't the only militia organization you write about in your book. You talk about something called the Enrolled Missouri Militia, which was almost a bunch of guys who were drafted.
Yes, it was essentially a draft. In 1862, the Governor Gamble and the commander of the federal troops in Missouri at the time, General Schofield, felt they needed more troops to cope with increased guerrilla warfare. The Enrolled Missouri Militia was to consist of any able-bodied man between the ages of 18 and 45, and they were to serve whenever they were called out. They were to sign up, and it was all loyal men, which created a good deal of controversy because you could go in and say, well, I'm not a loyal man, and so I don't have to be in the Enrolled Missouri Militia, but that sort of put a target on your back. These men were called out usually in just an emergency, maybe for 30 days or so, sometimes guarded bridges or towns. Occasionally, though, they were used to fight the guerrillas, and some of them did, in fact, fight guerrillas or even conventional Confederate troops when there were some raids or invasions of the state. Most of them didn't have any uniforms. Many of them didn't have any weapons at all. I'm not sure what they were supposed to do when they were called out if they didn't have any weapons. They didn't supply them with any weapons. And so I guess they marched around with broomsticks or something.
And then on we roll towards something called the provisional. Gosh, this is getting complex.
Yeah. Yeah, the provisional Enrolled Missouri Militia was supposed to be sort of the cream of the crop of the Enrolled Militia. And they were drafted into being a more extended service. And the provisional Enrolled Militia, 7 or 8 units, regiments were created. And they actually served for longer periods of time and frequently fought side by side with the Missouri State Militia.
So we had the Missouri State Militia, the Enrolled Missouri Militia, the Provisional Militia, all these militias brought up from the citizenry to fight guerrillas. Overall, were they doing much good? How effective were they, I guess, is a good question.
Well, obviously the government could not allow the guerrillas to run rampant.
Right.
They were successful in protecting transportation lines and major cities and towns. They were eventually successful in hunting down many of the guerrillas and killing them. And some of the major leaders like Bill Anderson and George Todd and others were killed during the war. It was probably as pretty much a standoff out in the countryside.
But somebody had to do something. Kevin from Faraway asks about the stars on the Confederate flag. There are more, as I recall, there than there were states who seceded, and one of them, does it represent Missouri?
Yes. The government of Missouri that fled the state, led by Governor Jackson, met in Neosho in November of 1861 and passed a secession ordinance and was at least nominally taken into the Confederacy, but it was never... The state of Missouri never actually effectively seceded, let's put it that way. It was never under the control of the Confederate government.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go take one more call. Billy from South Kansas City. Good morning, Billy.
Good morning. Just a comment that my mother, who was born in 1905, always told me when I was growing up that that my great uncle had been killed by Quantrell's men. I understood it to be Quantrell, only later Cantrell, that he was drinking from a stream, lying down drinking from a stream. And when they found his body, there were a whole bunch of, I don't know, she said 8 or 9, but I don't know what kind of guns they had. Men of Quantrell's men were also found dead at that site, that he had shot them before they got him. So that's a story I grew up with.
Okay, Billy, thanks so much for calling. It just goes to show that the memories are very, very long. We have an interesting thing coming here to Kansas City. The Missouri Valley Room of the Central Library at 10th and Baltimore is developing a small exhibition on the topic of Missouri guerrillas to coincide with the 150th anniversary of the Lawrence Raid, which is coming up this August. They'll be drawing from their collection of charcoal portraits of noted guerrillas, to borrow a phrase from Jonathan Newman Edwards. that was drawn in the 1890s for reasons unknown as yet. Are you familiar with these prints, Jim?
Yes, I've seen them. I think you can look at them online, and I have seen them, yes.
All right. So we want to express our appreciation to you for joining us today. Now, you've done the Gorilla Hunters book now. It's just out, and you had a book before that about gorillas.
Yes, it was Gorillas in Civil War, Missouri. The books actually are sort of complementary. The first book, Gorillas in Civil War, Missouri, focused primarily on the gorillas themselves, a bit about some of the more prominent gorillas in the course of the guerrilla warfare from their side. The Gorilla Hunters in Civil War, Missouri, focuses on the Union troops. There have been a number of books written about the gorillas, particularly in the last 20 years or so, but there really isn't or hasn't been, I'd like to say at least, one that focuses on the Union troops that fought the gorillas until my book. Of course, this is just an overview. I hope someday maybe to write a little bit more detailed book. But this one at least will get you started on the topic.
Well, thank you for taking on the project, and thank you, Jim, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
James W. Irwin joined us from Clayton Studios in St. Louis, Missouri. Once again, his book is Gorilla Hunters in Civil War, Missouri, just published by the History Press. Our show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz. Our announcer is Kim Noble. You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs on the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Up to Date is next with a look at art and independent films. I'm Monroe Dodd. This is Central Standard Friday, and have a great weekend.